This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. First, we look at a new program that could help track rape kits here in Wisconsin. These kits are a collection of evidence given by a victim after an assault. They can include fibers or hairs that may belong to the perpetrator, as well as bodily fluids. These kits often include photos of a victim's body and other information that could help bring the person responsible to justice. In 2014, a backlog of more than 7,000 kits was discovered in Wisconsin, including some that were from the 1980s. Now, the Wisconsin DOJ has proposed a new real-time tracking system, which it hopes will eliminate this problem and allow victims to advocate for their rights. The software program was announced by Wisconsin's Attorney General Josh Call. He joins me now to talk about it. Josh Call, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Right now, what does the backlog of untested rape kits look like in Wisconsin?
Well, in prior years, the Wisconsin Department of Justice conducted an inventory where a review was done of all the previously untested sexual assault kits in Wisconsin, and that discovered that there were thousands of kits that had gone untested. Over the course of several years, those kits were submitted for testing, and testing on the kits that were in that backlog is completed. But that inventory only went through the end of 2015. So what we are doing now is reaching out to agencies, among other things, to get information about kits that were collected from the beginning of 2016 on, so we can both see how the process is going, see what improvements have been made, and if there are any kits that should have been submitted that weren't, we're going to get information about that so we can follow up and make sure that they do get tested.
So right now we're not exactly sure how many kits may be untested in Wisconsin. Is that right?
We don't have a real-time way of tracking kits right now, and so we have to use inventories or censuses like we're doing currently. But one of the things we're working to do is to change that. We announced earlier this week that we have created a kit tracking system. We've acquired the technology for a kit tracking system, and that system is going to go live later this year. With that system, we'll be able to see in real time exactly what's going on with sexual assault kits around the state.
Yeah, so how is that going to work? Is it up to each agency to, agency in this case, I suppose, being either police stations, hospitals, is it up to each kind of organization that is responsible for these kits to input that information?
That's right. There will be different groups along the way that are inputting information. It would start with the sexual assault nurse examiner who is collecting the sexual assault kit, and that person would give information to the survivor who is reporting their sexual assault. Then it would go to the law enforcement agency, which would input information, and then the crime labs would put information into the system as well. Right now, we are going to be asking agencies around the state to participate in that kit tracking system, and I'm confident that the vast majority of agencies around the state, and maybe all agencies around the state, will participate, but we would also like to see legislation passed that makes this kit tracking system mandatory, because then instead of asking and hoping that agencies participate, we'll be able to ensure that every agency in the state is going to be part of this process.
I'd like to get back to legislation in just a bit, but more about the system itself. It's, of course, about accountability to some extent, especially with our history of not testing these kits. But how far does that accountability extend? Will this system allow victims to advocate for themselves in some ways?
It will empower victims. That's one of the reasons I think it's so important that we move forward with this. Right now, victims can contact law enforcement, certainly, and get information. But often what happens is that law enforcement, hopefully working as part of multidisciplinary teams with advocates and prosecutors, will reach out and contact victims. And that's how survivors learn about what's happening with their kits. What this system will do is it will allow survivors of sexual assault, anytime they want, to go online and to get information about where their kit is in the process. It will also give them contact information for law enforcement agencies, so they'll know who they can follow up with if they want further information. And it will have information that allows people to connect with victim services. So if they're interested in getting services, they can do that as well.
This gets to a bigger question that I had just about rape kits in general and how we prosecute rapes in the state of Wisconsin. What are the statutes of limitations on rape cases in Wisconsin? Is there a possibility that kits could be tested? Someone could be identified as a suspect, but due to the time it took to test these kits, that suspect could no longer be held accountable?
It's possible. The statute of limitations depends on which degree of sexual assault is charged. In a number of cases, the relevant statute of limitations is 10 years. But if a kit goes too long without being tested, it is possible that a case would be unable to be brought because of the statute of limitations. So one of the reasons that we need to test these kits promptly is to make sure that the statute of limitations doesn't run if you wait years and years. But even more important than that is, you know, every day that kits go untested in a case where you haven't identified the suspect is a day when somebody who has committed a serious violent crime may go unprosecuted, and a day when somebody who's a survivor of sexual assault has had to wait longer than they should have for justice.
I think that gets to some of the reforms that we've seen coming from Wisconsin, or some of the attempted reforms. There are two bills right now that passed the Wisconsin Senate this year that would change how the state of Wisconsin deals with rape kits. Can you unpack those a bit?
Yeah, there are two significant bills that in the last legislative session passed the Senate, but didn't get a hearing in the Assembly. And in this legislative session, again, have passed the Senate. And now they're awaiting a hearing in the Assembly, and I hope that that hearing happens soon. One of the bills would mandate that there be a sexual assault kit tracker in Wisconsin. Now, we're going to go forward and make sure that there's a tracking system in place regardless of what the legislature does. But this legislation would make it mandatory, and that means that agencies across the state would have to participate. And it also would mean that, you know, someday in the future when there's a different attorney general, this would ensure that that kit remains in place and that it wasn't a policy decision by the AG, but rather required by statute. The second bill would create timelines and a consistent process around the state for the submission and retention of sexual assault kits. One of the things that bill would do is require law enforcement agencies within 14 days of receiving a sexual assault kit to submit it to the crime labs for testing. That would make sure that kits are getting submitted in a timely fashion and that there's no backlog that could develop because agencies wouldn't be allowed to keep the kits for longer than a few weeks.
As you mentioned, there were similar bills passed the Senate, stalled in the Assembly. Do we know why they didn't get a hearing in the Assembly? And is there any reason to believe that won't happen again?
Well, you know, my take on it is that it was really a horrific example of partisan politics getting in the way of progress. The Assembly committee that was referred to just refused to hold a hearing on those bills, even though they had passed the Senate. I believe one passed on a voice vote and one passed unanimously. Rather than holding a hearing, though, the Assembly introduced an alternative bill that combined these measures with some other measures and included some aspects that made the bills certain to get vetoed if they had gotten that far. I'm hoping that won't happen again in this year's legislative session. You know, one of the bills was referred to a different committee. So I'm hoping that this year the legislature will take up the bills, hold hearings on them, and pass them, because these are bills that have support from a wide array of stakeholders, experts in this area. These bills have Republican authors, so there's strong bipartisan support for this. But we need the Assembly to hold a hearing on these bills.
If the Assembly once again fails to pass these reforms, how can the state reform the way it handles these kits and ultimately the way it protects or fails to protect survivors of sexual assault who decide to come forward?
Well, at the Wisconsin Department of Justice, we're going to move forward in strengthening our response to sexual assault regardless of what the legislature does. But we can do more as a state if the legislature is part of that effort. So we're going to be creating this kit tracking system, for example, but we can't mandate it without legislation. Likewise, we've sent out best practice guidance to agencies around the state requesting that agencies submit kits to the crime labs within 14 days. But again, we can't mandate that unless there's legislation. So we can do a lot to move things forward, and we're going to keep doing that. But it would be great to have the legislature joining us in that effort so we can send a clear message that Wisconsin takes sexual assault extremely seriously, that we're going to stand by and support survivors, and that we are absolutely committed to holding perpetrators accountable.
The tracking system you've mentioned, it's being funded by a federal grant of, I believe, more than $1.8 million that's really intended to help the state with rape kit reform in general. I'm guessing not all of the money is being used on that tracking system. Where else is it going to go?
That's right. The grant is used for a variety of different purposes, and it's one of a series of grants that the Wisconsin Department of Justice has obtained to support the work it's been doing with its sexual assault kit initiative. So a little over $325,000 of that grant is going to support the tracking system itself. Other parts of the grant are going to go to other related work with this technology that we're acquiring. It's known as the STACK system. So it will also relate to work being done by our state crime labs, which work to address, to test DNA evidence, including in sexual assault cases and other cases. What's notable about that system is it's been used in a few other states already. So it's been tested. Other states have had experience with it. In making the decision to acquire that system is reviewed the different options out there and selected the one that we thought was going to be the most effective for Wisconsin.
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing how this story moves forward, how this situation moves forward. But Josh Call, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Call is Wisconsin's Attorney General. He recently announced a new Department of Justice program that'll help track rape kits in real time. Now we continue our Earth Week series with a look at where Wisconsin stands in solar energy development. Governor Tony Evers' proposed state budget includes a number of items that would address climate change and renewable energy, like solar power. The administration is also preparing to release a draft of its clean energy plan. Renew Wisconsin, a nonprofit that promotes renewable energy, has been watching each new development very closely. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz spoke with its executive director Heather Allen and policy analyst Andrew Kell about solar energy in Wisconsin. Kell begins with describing how Wisconsin stacks up to other Midwest states.
With regards to solar development, Wisconsin has historically been kind of in the middle of the pack with regards to both all the United States and the Midwest regional states as well. I was looking at data at the Solar Energy Industry Association, and Wisconsin ranked 27th across all the United States. And in the Midwest, Minnesota was definitely leading us with regards to solar development. And that's been due to a lot of progressive policies that Minnesota has had to require utilities to develop solar, as well as recognizing the full value of solar, having integrated resource planning and other policies to both instigate utility scale as well as customer owned solar.
So then when we think about where Wisconsin stands to move in terms of solar in the foreseeable future, where are those greatest opportunities? Is one through the governor's proposed budget? Would that make a significant difference?
Yeah, I mean, the horizon is bright for sure. So basically, I mentioned Wisconsin's been in the middle of the pack with regards to development. But that being said, a lot of solar developments have been before the commission and are now before the commission right now for approval. So we've got the Two Creeks solar facility, which is 150 megawatts, that is now up and operating, that's near Manitowoc, and an additional 400 megawatts from Badger Hollow and Point Beach. They're under construction right now. And another 1,500 megawatts of proposed solar is under review before either the commission or local authorities that have regulatory oversight over facilities that are under 100 megawatts.
Okay. Can we dig into the budget? Are there elements that would fuel that push into more solar?
I can speak to that. Yeah. We're really excited about Governor Evers' budget proposals, which really weave a number of clean energy initiatives and green infrastructure initiatives into the budget. There's 28 provisions on clean energy and climate in his proposed budget. For us, there's some great areas we're excited to see hopefully move through the legislature. focus on energy program expansion would help to put more solar on rooftops, businesses, homes, farms, even in Wisconsin, and to advance energy efficiency work and potentially even expand that program into beneficial electrification, switching away from gas to electric heating and things like that, and electric appliances in buildings to reduce our dependence on gas. And there's a number of other opportunities here, including the state implementing its own existing principles on getting renewable energy and energy efficiency into all state-owned buildings, and really advancing that work, advancing electric vehicle charging and related programs to make the transition to electric vehicles easier. And for us, one of the most exciting programs is green job training through workforce development. Training workers for renewable energy jobs and green jobs throughout the state will help ensure that as we go through this economic transition, we see more and more Wisconsinites able to benefit from the jobs and economic growth that solar and wind, geothermal, biogas, biomass, and energy storage offer.
Did the governor take the Climate Action Task Force recommendations and really layered them into his budget?
Absolutely. This is the most ambitious energy budget, I think, ever in Wisconsin. I'm confident that some of these pieces that have been included in the budget, if they're not passed in the budget, I think that actually might be tricky, but they might be passed as separate, independent, standalone pieces of legislation. And we're hopeful to see that happen, whether it's in the budget or in standalone legislation. We do have high hope that something's going to happen here.
So let's touch back on Focus on Energy. What is its forecast for the coming year or so?
Historically, Focus on Energy budget is north of $100 million per year. Governor Evers' proposed budget does propose to double the Focus on Energy spending. So we are definitely in favor of that. That would not only put forward more measures for energy efficiency and conservation for Wisconsin's residents and businesses, but more renewable energy incentives as well, which we would support a doubling of essentially the incentives that come from grants specifically for renewable energy projects.
Focus is a very effective program that other states have recognized as a great model program. And so deepening our investment in Focus and expanding the work of Focus into these additional areas, we can sort of leapfrog to meet or exceed what our neighbors are doing in grid management and transitioning to renewable energy.
You're observing and watching and making sure people understand what's going on so that when the public has the opportunity to weigh in on these things, that they know what's going on and they understand this process better. Is that something you hope to clarify as we soar forward?
Absolutely. You know, Renew is celebrating its 30-year anniversary in 2021. We became an organization in 1991, and we have dedicated ourselves to educating the public and doing advocacy for renewable energy in Wisconsin since that date. So that's absolutely our mission. We're really excited to be on this show, talking to your audience, talking about the really extensive set of opportunities from a policy and a regulatory, legislative, and budgetary perspective that are before us today. In addition to everything that's happening in the government, we're also seeing a great deal of action at local government levels. Janesville has just made a commitment to carbon-free electricity. We've seen Brown County just did a bunch of work on renewable energy. They just passed a resolution. So we're seeing from border to border all across Wisconsin, local governments are getting in the mix. So you've got state government, you've got local government. And then one of the reasons there's so much hope here and there's so much potential is that the costs of renewable energy now often beat the costs for fossil fuel energy. There's a report called Why Local Solar for All Costs Less, and it's analysis of a number of different scenarios nationwide that shows that what we're calling distributed energy resources, or DERs, we're talking about solar, customer-owned solar on rooftops and things like that, that it can actually lower costs across the entire electricity system compared with alternatives while maintaining reliability and resilience. And when we saw the situation in Texas, you know, one of the things that I took away from the lessons learned in Texas is that if you have generation geographically distributed around a state or a region, and the utilities have the capability to fine-tune which parts of the grid are turned on or off at a certain time. And if you add energy storage to that picture, you can prevent a number of blackouts and brownouts and reduce the duration of those events, which can save a lot of money and sometimes even lives. And I think that that's really important as we're thinking about not just avoiding future emissions, but also protecting us from extreme weather events that are becoming more frequent. All of this fits together in the picture of, you know, what our future grid needs to look like. It needs to be nimble, it needs to be dynamic, and it needs to have renewables at all scales and in a variety of locations so that you can respond to weather and you can have the flexibility to generate resources from different parts of the state or even the region.
Finally, is there an example of an initiative? Is there something in your experience that stands out?
I think that the state has the potential to expand community solar quite dramatically by creating a statewide framework for community solar. So Minnesota has nearly 800 megawatts of solar in these sort of small solar farms that people can buy into. And Wisconsin has a few community solar farms that you can sort of sign up for through your utility bill, but we don't have nearly enough. We can't compete with Minnesota yet because we don't have a statewide framework. So we're looking to see that happen. I'm optimistic that that can happen, but if you'll let me shift the conversation just a tiny bit, I am super excited about something that's happening in a couple of rural communities where actually two counties, Vernon County and Iowa County, are both pursuing, they're creating energy districts. And energy districts, for those who are familiar with soil and water conservation districts, they follow the same model. It's about local engagement, locally identifying problems and solutions to help manage their own energy. And it's very exciting to see people get interested and to learn more about energy and to understand that they have a stake in the game and to understand that they have a role to play. You know, 10 years from now, maybe you could see every county in Wisconsin has an energy district and every county in Wisconsin is getting support for technical assistance to do solar on rooftops and to do energy efficiency work and to work with their utility to find shared goals that they can advance. Maybe it's a local community solar project or electric vehicle chargers. And so truly what makes my heart sing is seeing people who care about energy going to meetings, establishing a community organization, learning about energy, and then working on energy, you know, in their free time. It's amazing to see it happening, and it's really sort of bubbling up naturally. And we just couldn't be more thrilled.
Yeah, I mean, one really exciting, I would say, kind of game-changing development that happened very recently, and that's, you know, solar being paired with energy storage. That is the key. We used to use the term holy grail of the energy grid with regards to getting 100% renewable future grid is storage, because we need ultimately resources to be able to balance the grid and have, you know, 24/7 always available energy for our energy needs. That being said, Wisconsin utilities have put forward some proposals before the commission now for large-scale solar plus battery applications. And we've seen a couple of those now. One is called Paris, one's called Darien, in which utilities are partnering with Invenergy to have large-scale battery storage hooked up with or paired with large-scale solar. And that is going to be the key if we want to get to a roadmap to zero carbon and 100% renewable energy. We have to have that paired with storage and resources that can ultimately balance the grid. So that's something that's really exciting to me, because when I was in grad school 10 plus years ago, that again was a hypothetical, you know, when the economics of batteries came to be so that utilities would start deploying that, that's when we can get to 100% energy grid. And that's something now that we can kind of see a light at the end of the tunnel and have something technically available for a clean energy grid in the future.
So that technology exists or it's under development?
Well, both. It exists and it's constantly being improved upon and under development. So that's something the utility scale battery is going to be tested out for the first time. But through microgrid experience, now utilities and customers have had experience with batteries being paired with solar and other types of generators to be able to make sure that it works. And now that's something that's going to be paired together at the grid level and be used for evening out the production of solar and wind and other resources that would normally be intermittent and have to use it whenever it's available sort of thing. This can be evened out throughout the day, evening, afternoon, constantly available with regards to energy storage. And also there's balancing or ancillary services. There is a constant need for that. And again, battery storage will be able to provide that when paired with solar and wind and other renewable resources.
So I think what I hear you saying is that the fact that the utilities are proposing this is a big step in itself. Not so long ago, we were hearing a lot about clean coal, for instance, and now we're hearing, let's go with these batteries and with this renewable technology.
Right. And the reason I call it a game changer is that if utilities are proposing it, that means the economics are there now. So we're going to start seeing more and more of that. And that's why when I look at the horizon, it is very bright with regards to 100% renewable energy future.
Heather Allen is the executive director, and Andrew Kell is a policy analyst for Renew Wisconsin, a nonprofit that promotes renewable energy in the state. They spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz as part of our Earth Week series. Tune in tomorrow to learn about the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund and the work it does to improve natural areas, outdoor recreation, and water quality here in Wisconsin. Coming up, although plants like pothos or monstera are very common houseplants, they're actually native to tropical areas.
When you think of the tropics, you think of humidity and warmth. And then you think of our indoor homes. You know, the air is drier, especially when the heat is on. So we have low humidity. We may have drafts of hot or cold air from the heat and air conditioning. And our light may be okay, but often we don't have sufficient light.
In about 13 minutes, we'll learn how to best care for tropical plants at home. First, we'll hear from the owners of Milwaukee's only black and brown-owned plant shop, who just opened a storefront in the city. So you can head over there, pick up some tropical plants, and know how to make your home a great space for them. That's all coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Over the last year, many businesses have had to rethink how they do things. Curbside pickup has become key to many businesses staying afloat. And one new Milwaukee business that started as strictly curbside pickup recently made the jump to brick and mortar. Michelle Alfaro and Mag Rodriguez started Miranta Plant Shop as a pop-up in the fall of last year. It's now the only black and brown run plant store in the city. And just last week, they opened up a storefront in Milwaukee's Bronzeville neighborhood. WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke to Alfaro and Rodriguez ahead of the store opening as part of our series, COVID Earners. It highlights how black and brown businesses have responded and adapted to the pandemic. Rodriguez begins with how the shop got started.
Michelle and I were talking about how people were reaching out to her about like her plants. She would post them on her story. And she was like, people want to buy plants. I think the initial conversation was like, people keep coming to me. Like, I sell plants, but I don't. I just buy a ton of plants. And, you know, we were just like, well, how about we put a pop-up together where people can buy them online and they can just come pick them up. And we put the pop-up together. Like, it started off as like a joke, kind of, not necessarily a joke, but something we're just doing for fun. And very quickly, it was like, oh, there's actually a business model here. There's good margins. We started sourcing plants from various parts of the country. And yeah, it just kind of like came together and this idea of like a temporary solution to a big problem, which was people want plants. They don't want to go to the store. They want to just drive up, pick them up, and go on their way. luckily, well, I won't say luckily, but, you know, because a lot of bad has happened in the past year, but the world is slowly trying to recover into a new way of life. Mm-hmm. And we're now trying to adapt. I think it's, you know, people ask, like, how did you guys adapt to the pandemic? To us, it's like, we're trying to adapt into what the world looks like after the pandemic. But that's where we're at right now.
So, you know, would you say that this is a new business model entirely? Like, would you have come up with this model if it wasn't the pandemic? And is this something that you foresee sustaining yourselves post-pandemic, doing things the way you're doing it?
I don't think it's a new business model. I think the only thing that was new about it was, so for us, we were just taking a business model that exists now, which is e-commerce, and the startup model of like really pushing on digital and creating content that's fun and engaging and incorporating into a essentially an industry that's a little bit dated. Mm-hmm. So I think it was we were just blending it together. And I think that's the best way to define Maranta.
Yeah. And I feel like on top of that, a lot of these, at least for me, my personal experience going to Plant Shop, they don't really give you the educational tool version of it. And like, for me, it's such a passion that I would want, you know, anyone to know and have the confidence in knowing that they are capable of taking care of a plant, how to become a proper plant parent, how to take care of your plant. And a lot of people always come for me for advice. So I feel like that's also very important, the educational piece of it, the history part of it, you know, all of that is, it's what matters, you know, it's the main thing and heart reason that we're doing this.
And I think that's where the disruption happened in mm-hmm. it as well. When you scroll through our website, there isn't just a plant with a price on there. It's, you get the origin country of where this plant originates from and, mm-hmm. you know, all the care information up until, is this safe for your pet or not, which we're not really seeing in most plant shops.
Mm-hmm. What does having Maranta Plant Shop be a Black and brown owned business mean to you guys, mean in Milwaukee, mean in the communities that you engage with? You talked about it a little bit just in terms of generationally with Gen Z and millennials seeing kind of a connection to plants. But what about race and ethnicity?
Absolutely. I feel like, you know, I'm Afro-Latina and Mag is Mexican. And I feel like it's like my duty and due diligence to carry that representation for who's to come after me and for my ancestors. And it's something that, when I'm taking care of my plants, I connect them very closely to my ancestors, and it's an ode to them, essentially. You know, we have to keep that alive, and, you know, you don't see that anymore. You know, we've lost touch, and so it's all about the representation for me. Not only that, but being a woman, too.
Yeah. You know, a lot of plants that are being sold that are house plants that we just kind of take for granted now come from Central, South America, Africa, the Caribbean, and I think that has been lost over time. I think just historically, if you think of, you know, the first expeditions to the Americas were funded by people looking for spices and plants. And for us to be the first and only Black and brown owned plant shop in Milwaukee, one of the country's most segregated cities, I think we're not only paving a way for a new generation of entrepreneurs, but the amount of messages and comments that we receive from Black and brown folks who are like, wow, you inspired me to launch my thing and do my thing. And ultimately, we're just trying to inspire people to take space and space that they deserve. And, you know, just yesterday, Michelle did a panel with Milwaukee Magazine. And not only was Michelle the youngest in the panel, but also the only woman of color in this woman panel. And I think there might have been 5, 6, 10, 20 young women of color looking at this and being like, wow, that could be me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, and for Michelle to be standing next to, you know, women who are established in the business startup community, have been around for 10, 20 years. And for her to be in this panel and like really take up some space, I think that means a ton for all of us. And, you know, for me working in the startup space and in that ecosystem, I wish I could say that I worked with more Black and brown founders, and it's definitely a blessing and it means a lot.
Yeah. And I think it's needed, you know, it's needed to disrupt the systems that we've grown so accustomed to. And I'm hoping that we can continue to inspire more Black and brown folks to be the disruptors.
What are some of the other innovative ways that you're trying to connect with people who need plants, with people from all sorts of communities, that kind of thing.
I mean, we're doing a lot, which I think is the thing. So I'm going to try to focus on the main things. The thing that excites me the most, every single Monday we do a Monstera Monday giveaway. So a Monstera, for those who don't know, is one of the most popular plants. It's also known as a Swiss cheese plant. It's a very beautiful philodendron green plant that has cuttings on it, natural cuttings. Mm-hmm. And it's also one of the most popular plants. It is also not, it's pretty expensive. So every Monday we make an effort to give one away. And that's honestly what's been growing a lot of our social presence. To date, we've given away, I don't know, maybe like 30 plants.
Probably more than that.
You know, just a couple weeks ago, we gave away a variegated Monstera, which is a very rare form of that same plant that usually sells from $600 to $1,000. And, you know, for us to be able to give away these plants, you know, the pandemic has been hard for a lot of people. And mm-hmm. being able to create something that's accessible for someone who probably couldn't afford the plant, they can bring a piece of life with them home and build their space. I think through that and on the other side, we're also very well, like we're well immersed in the art and music culture. Mm-hmm. So one of the initiatives that we started were the Maranta Hue series, where we partner with a local black or brown artist to essentially design our care cards. Our care cards are these cards that every single plant comes with that teaches people how to take care of their plant. There's also something really cool that you could put on your fridge because it has some beautiful art in it as well. And, you know, I think those are the two main initiatives outside of like mm-hmm. our social media. If you haven't had a chance to look at our social media, go check us out and or really check out Michelle. Michelle's very fun and immersive.
A lot of good cool photos of Michelle.
Yeah, but I'm excited to see what else we can, you know, come up with and, you know, just finding innovative, fun ways to, you know, spread the word about us. And not only that, but just create like a community.
Yes. And on that note of community, do you think that we talked a little bit about creative ways to staying open and things that you were doing. Are there any things that could help you guys going forward? Anything from loans to programs to anything, policy changes, anything that you feel like could help a small business like yours thrive?
I think it's a systematic problem, mm-hmm. but I think the hardest thing was we just signed a lease to our brick and mortar. And we have a beautiful space mm-hmm. In Brownsville right in front of the MLK statue. So it's very symbolic to what we're doing.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the hardest things for us was finding, I guess, funding for what we're doing. We have become a business that's generating really good revenue. We've been profitable since day one. But even, you know, Michelle coming from the financial world, it's been very difficult for us to even get a business credit card. So I guess like funding, you know, for the most part, we're very blessed and we know we're in a unique situation where we have enough cash flow that we can like bootstrap this ourselves. Yeah. But I do think of other black and brown owned businesses who probably aren't in the same position or someone who's starting their own business, how difficult it can be to do.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, the brick and mortar shop is pretty amazing. Do you guys have particular plans for it?
Yeah, so we plan on opening our doors April 14th. So time is moving by very, very quickly for us, but we're really, really excited to actually have a home for everyone to come and, you know, share space with us.
I will note April 14th marks exactly 6 months since we launched Maranta. Mm-hmm. So
very, very special day.
Very special day. And I'll mention, without giving away too much right. of what we hope to do, the plant shop is just phase one of what we're really hoping this space to become. Mm-hmm. Although it is Maranta Plant Shop, and just Maranta as a whole is going to become a bigger ecosystem that we hope to build out beyond just plants. But I think plants being the thing that kind of glues everything together.
Yes.
Michelle Alfaro and Mag Rodriguez are the co-owners and co-founders of Maranta Plant Shop here in Milwaukee. They spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver as part of our series COVID Earners. And if you make your way down to Maranta and purchase a lovely Monstera or Pothos, you'll want to stay tuned for our next segment. Gardening contributor Melinda Myers gives her tips on how to care for tropical plants in your home. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. For many of us, the pandemic inspired new hobbies, and one of the most popular has been indoor gardening. Luscious ferns and cascading vines have become a mainstay in many homes. But most of these plants aren't native to areas like Wisconsin. In fact, many of them are from tropical climates with high humidity and fertile soil. Since most Wisconsin homes are a lot less hospitable than the rainforest, how do we make them the ideal place for these plants? Melinda Myers has some ideas. Myers is a gardening expert and a regular Lake Effect contributor, and she joins me now. Melinda, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Always a pleasure, Joy.
Something I realized pretty recently, many of the plants that we think of as common indoor plants, like pothos or ZZ plants, they're actually from tropical climates. And it made me wonder, are our homes actually well-suited to tropical plants, or are these just attractive plants that some of us are doomed to kill?
That's a great question. When you think of the tropics, you think of humidity and warmth. And sometimes, depending on where they fall in that tropical rainforest, are they up high getting sunlight or down low tolerating shade? And then you think of our indoor homes. You know, the air is drier, especially when the heat is on. So we have low humidity, the temperatures, we may have drafts of hot or cold air from the heat and air conditioning. And our light may be okay, but often we don't have sufficient light. So it can be challenging. And that's why it's really important to match those tropical plants to the growing conditions in your house or supplement to help mimic some of those tropical conditions, you know, like humidity and maybe light if you don't have sufficient light. So we can make it work, but you're right. We need to kind of look at where those plants are from, our indoor environment, and how we can make it better for those plants and easier for us to maintain.
Keeping in mind what many of our homes are like, what are the kinds of plants that do well indoors, even though they're from the tropics?
You know, the pothos and philodendron are two plants many people are familiar with. And I always, when I recommend those, sometimes gardeners will roll their eyes going, oh, do you have anything better to recommend? You know, they're low maintenance. They'll tolerate low light. They really do okay with lower humidity. And they like benign neglect. Water thoroughly and let them go slightly dry. The good news is there's lots of new cultivars out there. Some like neon that are kind of a chartreuse and really brighten up your indoor garden. Some like Brazil that have this fine line down the middle, Marble Queen with some silver variegation on the pothos. So you can find a lot of a variety available so that you can really grow some of those hard to kill, I maybe should say easy to grow plants, and still have a fresh new look. And philodendrons, you can get some that are climbing as well. So you can train them up a, you know, usually it's a sphagnum post so that they kind of help grasp onto it and you'll get them. I need to do a little bit of twist and tie to hold them upright, but you can have more of a floor plant than hanging basket, tabletop. So those are some good ones to start with. ZZ plant is the one you see in, you know, hotels and shopping malls. And it's a wonderful plant because it's got arching branches, fine leaves that are very thick and succulent, very good low light plant, and it likes to go dry between watering. So it's one of those plants that doesn't need the humidity and moisture that so many of the tropical plants do. And so it starts out, you could get a small one at the garden center that may be only, you know, 8 or 12 inches tall, but eventually it can be 3 feet tall and can have be quite impressive as well. One that always makes me cringe a little is the fiddle leaf fig that I see it in so many decoration, you know, home decor magazines and things. And it's always up against a white wall, away from a window, and it looks great, but they put it there for the photo shoot, then take it away as soon as the photo shoot's over, because fiddle leaf figs really like good bright light. And we stick them in a dark corner, and they may look nice against the white wall, but they start dropping their leaves, and pretty soon they die. So, you know, matching those light conditions is really important. Water it thoroughly. You can let it go slightly dry, the top inch or so slightly dry, and water it again. And so that's one that I always get a little nervous when I see it in a magazine or somebody says, oh, I just bought one and I put it against this wall and it's, you know, there's no window in sight. So it's one of those we need to be careful. Grouping your plants together not only makes a nice display, but boosts the humidity. So that's another way you can help create that tropical feel for you and the plants. So looking for, you know, maybe get a tray, a decorative tray, fill it with some pebbles so you can elevate the pot above that tray. Every time you water, the excess water goes in the tray, the pot's elevated above the water. And then as one plant transpires or loses moisture through the leaves, it increases the humidity to its neighbors. And as the water in the tray evaporates, it increases the humidity around the plant. So that's a trick you can use in terms of trying to get that humidity where the plants really prefer.
You know, you mentioned with the philodendron that it likes to grow up sometimes. I've heard that pothos also enjoys that. And when we think about these different tropical plants, of course, they grew in different parts of a tropical forest, most likely. How important is it to mimic the conditions that it would grow in naturally?
That's an excellent observation. So if you have been to like Hawaii or someplace like that, you would see pothos and philodendron climbing up the trees towards the light. But they're really shaded by the canopy of those larger trees that they're climbing on. And so that's a good indication that, yeah, that's native to an area where, yeah, it has high humidity, even though it does tolerate some of those lower humidity situations, but low light because it's on the lower part of that tropical forest. And so if we know where the plants grow naturally, we can try to mimic those conditions indoors so that we have success.
When you're thinking about buying one of these plants for your home, what should you keep in mind about both making sure that your home is more hospitable, but also making sure that you're setting yourself up and your plant for success?
Great idea. Hopefully there's a good plant tag that has the proper name of the plant. This isn't always the case, and some proper care. If it doesn't, talk to the staff. Hopefully they're well informed and they can help you or do some research ahead of time so that you know that the plant you select will tolerate the light conditions in your home. Or, you know, LED lights and plant lights have really come down in price and are energy efficient. So sometimes, especially in winter in our area, days are short, they're gray. You know, supplementing with some artificial lights really going to boost your success. Again, you know, matching the plant not only to the light, but the type of care. If you tend to give your plants TLC, then you want something that's going to need a lot of water, like a fern. If you're like me, that really goes for benign neglect, I need plants that really tolerate going a bit drier between watering, you know. So you want to match those needs to your style of gardening or your schedule. You know, if you travel a lot, if you're busy, you know, if you're not home or you want something that looks nice, but you don't have to do a lot of work, pick a plant that's going to do that for you, that is going to survive with that benign neglect. And if you tend to kill your plants with kindness, then look for those that like moisture, the ferns. You know, maidenhair fern is nice, frosty fern, which is one you see a lot during the holidays. And so there are a lot of plants out there that we can do to match our growing conditions and our style. And the other thing is, we all kill plants along the way. I've killed a few, and I learned something. You know, it's either one that I'm going to change my care the next one I buy of that type, or I'm not going to buy it again because it's not a good match for me, my growing conditions, or the way I like to manage my plants.
All right. Well, Melinda Myers, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you.
Melinda Myers is a gardening expert and the author of many books on the topic, including Small Space Gardening and Midwest Gardener's Handbook. Myers is leading a webinar tonight at 6:30. It's all about creating and designing environmentally conscious landscapes. You can find more information as well as our previous conversations with Myers at wuwm.com. And that is today's Lake Effect. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll tell you all about a unique drink you can find only at Colectivo Coffee for a very short time, the Blue Moon Latte. We'll tell you everything you need to know before you try this fruity drink that tastes like Blue Moon ice cream. That's tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.